2000 or 2001. But regardless of the official start date, it is a time for taking stock of where we are as a culture, where we are as a society. And I'm certain that we will be doing that in many ways over the next year or so on this very program. And we'll also be doing that, getting some help in doing that, from speakers in a series that will begin next week and continue into 2001, a series titled Millennium 2000, which is being organized by the folks at St. Patrick's Church in Urbana, made possible with some funds by the Illinois Humanities Council. There is a long list of rather distinguished speakers that is projected, including Rabbi Kushner, Lawrence Kushner, who we've talked with before on this program, Luke Timothy Johnson, a theologian from Emory University, Miriam Wright Edelman from the Children's Defense Fund in Washington, D.C., and many others. And we hope to have these folks here on the program around the time that they are scheduled to speak in this series. It is, as I mentioned, getting underway next week, and we have with us this morning the lead speaker in the series, who is going to try to set the stage and ask some rather basic questions about where we are right now, and doing that in a spiritual sort of context, that is, in terms of American spirituality, where we are right now. And our guest for the program is Bill Sutton. He is a member of the faculty of the University High School, and has taught there since 1992, except for one period of a year-long period, 94-95, when he was a visiting assistant professor in the Department of History at the University of Illinois. He holds Ph.D. in history from the U of I and is interested particularly in the history of American Protestantism. He's published articles on American 19th century and working class religion in a number of important religious studies journals. Has recently published a book titled Journeyman for Jesus, Evangelical Artisans Confront Capitalism in Jacksonian Baltimore, won the Kenneth Scott LaTourette Prize for Modern Religious History. Last year, he was granted a Pew Evangelical Scholars Research Fellowship to study the class, religious, and gender aspects of the artisan-led Washington Temperance Society of the 1840s. And he is going to speak for the first speech in this Millennium 2000 series next week, talking about where we come from, where we are, and where we're going. Good, important, large questions that we will not completely answer here this morning, but at least we will take a shot at it. And of course, as we talk, people who are listening are welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people who are listening have questions. They're welcome to call in and to join the conversation. All we ask is that people are brief so that we can accommodate as many callers as possible and kind of keep things moving along. But anybody is welcome to call in and pose questions and make comments. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. It's good to be here.
I know some of the issues that you want to take up in the talk that you're going to give, and we don't really want to give that away. And we don't want you to give it now because we want people to go and hear you when you talk next week. But there are so many questions, so many potential questions that we can perhaps raise some of those that you're not planning on talking about in the talk. And maybe a good place to start, as all of these topics really do have to do with questions of sort of spirituality in American life one way or another, maybe start right there with the observation that we are told, at least popular media has told us, and so I guess we believe it, that, well, I don't know, over the last decade perhaps, it seems that religion, issues of spirituality, have become more and more important to more and more Americans. And one has to wonder why that is.
Well, that is a $64,000 question, and my sense of that, and all of this is, of course, very impressionistic, but my sense of that is that perhaps these questions were more important to Americans than people were always willing to acknowledge. My sense is that there is, in fact, in this country, something that can be called a cultural elite, and it's popular, you know, popular media part of that, the Academy part of that. Neither one of those particular aspects of culture, I think, have been very, very open to the idea of spirituality. Or if they have considered spirituality, it's usually seems to be directed at the less of the more dysfunctional aspects of spirituality. Just an example, the very popular movie last year, The Apostle, that Robert Duvall kind of carried out apparently largely by himself, couldn't get it funded in Hollywood for years and years. And I assume part of that is because he refused to treat spirituality as an essentially dysfunctional phenomenon. Hmm.
Is there, do you think, something about the approach of the millennium? Obviously, for some people, this is, particularly evangelical Christians, this is a very important milestone. And as was the case when approaching the first millennium, when we were people getting near to the year 1000, people think this might be a critical time in human history. And maybe the end of human history are important turning point, but and for everyone else, it is indeed again an important milestone. But I'm not quite in the same way. Do you think that somehow that these two things are related? That interest in spirituality and this the fact that we're going to turn the clock and turn the calendar, or is that just sort of incidental, and it has more to do with other aspects of contemporary life in America? Then that's really what's driving. You know, if people are going back to church, if people are getting more serious about prayer, if people are getting more serious about their spiritual life, there are all sorts of other things about postmodern life that are causing that to happen, and the other stuff is kind of incidental.
That would be my take on it from my perspective, but it's also true that, again, I think in you know, kind of the popular culture, people are willing, I think, to hear kind of strange things about the millennium. I think there's always this kind of titillating factor about spirituality that draws some people. I recently heard that Jerry Falwell is now making comments. Have you heard this? He's making comments about the existence of the Antichrist and his conviction that Jesus will return sometime in the next 10 years. And I suppose that may resonate for some people. To me, it strikes me as a kind of a desperate way to kind of regain the public's attention from a person whose credibility, I'm afraid, is slipping. I base that on the fact that his Liberty University basketball team is next to last in the RPI ratings. The only worst team is Yale, so you can make sense of that if you want. Hmm.
One of the things that certainly we have seen, at least over the last decade and maybe going back further, is the apparent growth in numbers, in strength, in influence, in profile of traditionalist. I hesitate to use the word fundamentalist because for a lot of people that has negative connotations. More sort of traditionalist, non-mainline Protestantism in this country. And I'm particularly interested in your reflection on it, since this is a particular area of interest of yours. Is that something that have we come to a turn in that, or is that something that we're expecting to continue to see?
Good question. And my sense of it is that you've really put your finger on something important, and I think it is important not to use the word fundamentalist too much because it is such a dismissive term. And I do think traditionalism is the correct approach, and because there's so much of traditionalism. Traditionalism is so broad. Fundamentalism really isn't. It's a very narrow category. And there's so much within not just American Protestantism, but Catholicism, Jewry, that there's such a rich, so many resources of tradition that I think people are looking at, and I think the spirituality is part of that. And I think that what's happened in Protestantism is that you do have these kind of ends of the spectrum. You have a fundamentalist end, which has taken out of the Bible, out of Protestant tradition, certain stances, certain standards, and made them litmus tests. And if you agree with those litmus tests, then you're part of the chosen people. If you don't, then you are othered. You are outside the realm of acceptability. On the other end of the spectrum, we have liberal Protestantism, which seems to move further and further away from kind of traditional Protestant beliefs, really embracing the notion of tolerance, which of course is not a bad notion, but at a certain point it seems like you know, people of faith have to kind of say, this is what we believe, and you're welcome to believe something else. But I think liberal Protestantism has kind of pushed those boundaries out to the point where people aren't sure where the foundations are anymore. And so between the very constrictive fundamentalism and the liberal Protestantism that's almost amorphous, there's a lot of space. And I think that's where people are kind of looking around for, is there some sort of other, are there other traditions that we have missed here, that we have, that we've bypassed, that we've ignored, that we can somehow resurrect in a way that really makes sense to us and to our lives.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm glad you made the point. I think that it is true that we should acknowledge that if there does seem to be something going on here, move to recapture some more fundamental, basic, traditional, text-based, I don't know, whatever kind of word you want to apply to it. If something like that is going on in Christianity, we also have to acknowledge, as you did, that it's not just something that's going on in Christianity. Right. It's going on in other faiths too,
right,
which perhaps should give us reason to if we're not paying attention to it, to pay attention to it, because it's not simply something that's happening in Christianity. It seems to be happening all around,
right,
and it must, you know, you have to think that it's in reaction to the spirit, you know, the spirit of the time,
mm-hmm,
and so worth paying attention to.
Right. I mean, I think there's a sense, really a broad sense, that the old truisms of modernism no longer hold. And those who are not even the least bit interested in religious or spiritual answers still, as postmodernists, recognize that that's the case. So it seems that there's this really kind of, it's kind of wide open at this point. And yet people still, everybody still carries along their own baggage and their own kind of prejudices, cultural expectations about religion, about spirituality, that I would argue tend to limit the options. There's still this. I mean, part of what I want to talk about is this whole process of deprivileging spirituality. The idea that it can't be authentic. That there must be some other. Explanation for spiritual phenomenon, for spiritual experience. It must be due to economic stresses or some sort of psychological dysfunction. And that is, I think, a very serious problem that needs to be addressed.
We have a couple of callers. One that's on a car phone, so I want to get right to them. This is line number 4. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. Could your guest please appraise the pontificate of John Paul II historically the past 20 years?
Appraise?
Appraise?
Yeah. Well, I can comment on it. Being neither a Catholic nor a close student of Catholicism makes my comments not particularly, may not be particularly helpful. My sense of John Paul is that he has really tried to kind of balance competing forces within Catholicism. He has maintained a very strict traditionalism with respect to, say, ordination of women, married priests, those sort of very traditional Catholic practices. But he has also, I think, emphasized these notions of spirituality and of spiritual discipline as opposed to kind of spiritual entertainment, the sort of thing that you get too often with kind of American Protestant charismatics. My sense of him is that he's trying to maintain that balance between, maintaining those kind of traditional stances, but also kind of re-emphasizing some traditional stances that will bring more life and more energy to the Catholic Church.
Does that get at your question?
Yeah, pretty much. What about in the secular field, world affairs, communism, things like that?
Communism opens another conversation that I think could be really, really interesting for religious peoples in general, but especially for American Christians, Protestants, Catholics, American Jews. Communism was structured constructed in the 1950s and 1960s as the epitome of atheism, and in fact, part of it was. And capitalism then was constructed as the necessary opposite of communism, so that anything that was capitalist was necessarily non-communist. Anything that was capitalist was therefore godly, because communism was atheistic. And I think in that process of construction, I think something really, really unfortunate has happened. And that is that we have lost any sense, as Americans, we've lost any sense of being able to critique the morality of capitalism. To say that capitalism is not necessarily moral, to acknowledge that there are aspects of capitalism that are, in fact, inherently immoral, is not to say that we are communist. But that has basically been the dialogue for the last 40 years since the Cold War, and I think that's I think that's very unfortunate. How John Paul fits into that, I'm not at all sure. I mean, I understand that as well. I think the experience in Poland probably speaks to that, because the Polish overthrow of communism was very much dependent upon the Catholic Church, and the inability of communism to maintain itself in Poland to a large extent was due to the staying power of the Catholic Church within the Polish population.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Right. Here's another caller. This is Urbana, and it's line one.
Oh, good morning.
Yes.
You were speaking earlier of the source of the impulse to the spiritual. I'm paraphrasing a philosopher whose name escapes me at the moment, who said there are three fundamental questions. What am I really worth? How can we live in security and loving harmony? What may we hope for? And I think the impulse to question one, the purpose of one's being, or the hope for one's being, is always there if there's a spark of reflection or thought. And I think in our case, you know, we inevitably turn to the Christian culture still, because that's the culture that, in a sense, created the country. And it looks back to 6,000 or more years of history. It's incredibly rich and diverse. And it surrounds us. I mean, it's implicit and explicit in educational, governmental schemes, in the way we lay out our land, the way we make law. So it's hardly surprising, I think that, you know, whatever the occasion, when a lot of individuals decide to think about things at the same time, that we would be thinking about Christian culture. But my question is, there's also, you know, we're, in a sense, everyone, almost everyone's a fish in a Christian sea here. Christianity and those West European, Mediterranean, Jewish, Judeo-Christian beliefs touch us. We breathe it, whatever our philosophical position is. But what I'm wondering about is the Muslim sea, the Buddhist sea, these other seas. The thing that's really different about our time and the first century of Christianity is the fact that culture overleaps national boundaries now. What do you see happening in the next hundreds of years? Is this going to be synthesis or war or a war of culture? Or what's your perception? And I'll listen.
Well, I need to start that by acknowledging that I'm a high school history teacher, not a prophet. And it seems to me that there are a couple of choices, and one of them, as you mentioned, is the kind of fundamentalist Armageddon take that sooner or later the Christians and the Jews will be fighting the Muslims for not just the Holy Land, but for the final restoration of all things. I couldn't possibly comment on the accuracy or inaccuracy of that. As far as a synthesis, an interesting idea. I can't quite get a hold of that right off the top of my head. What the alternative that appeals to me, however, is an acknowledgement of the kind of open market of ideas, whereby faith would be willing and able to express their kind of fundamental faith statements and give people the option and the opportunity to embrace those, or to embrace some other ones, or to embrace none at all, but where there wouldn't be any particular restrictions on presenting the options, where it would really be a kind of an open market, and when people are looking for where they can encounter God, where they can encounter a sort of the kind of spiritual experience that gives their life meaning, as you mentioned in your first question, seems to me that people ought to have enough confidence in their own faith to be able to put those things out as options, and not force people to choose them, and not limit the people from taking up those options. Does that address your?
Well, the caller hung up, so we can hope that it did. And if he would like to follow up, he can certainly call back. I wanted to go back for a second to the question about if indeed there is resurgence of spirituality in America, and is there something about, and perhaps other places as well, and is there something about the time in which we find ourselves that it is driving that? And I don't want to give the impression that I know more about postmodernism than I do. I want to be very careful about wading into this, but it does strike me that that one of the features of postmodernism is that it is a very sort of mediated culture, in the sense that we have come to the point where a lot of folks are sort of afraid to decide what they feel on their own, and they're looking for somebody else to tell them how they feel about stuff. And that, you know, maybe the interest in a more traditionalist kind of approach to religion is indeed a rejection of that feature of postmodernism. And what people are saying is that however they define God, they're saying, I want to have a personal, non-mediated relationship. I don't want to go through anybody else. And it's somehow trying to recapture that notion of the personal connection, which it would indeed be a response to or rejection of one aspect of postmodern culture.
I agree totally. I mean, I think that really, you know, the amorphousness of the postmodernist perspective works really well for the privileged, it seems to me, because they're already in good shape one way or the other, psychologically, intellectually, materially. It's all right for them. They're going to get by. But for a lot of the rest of us, this is not at all good news that there's really nothing out there, that it's all a matter of people constructing things and you know, changing the language and whatever. This is not particularly good news. And neither is it particularly true in any, however we use that word, true. But it is very much, it's very powerfully articulated at this point. And I think the reaction of many people, and I think the reaction of many Americans who, again, traditionally are rather ornery in these respects, has been to come up against that and say, well, you know, I don't know. Maybe there is some truth out there somewhere. The idea that there is no truth is, after all, a true statement, or it means nothing at all. So maybe there is something out there, and I guess I'm going to have to go look for it. And I think your point that people are wanting to look for the kind of the direct connection is, I think, in fact, the case. And I think it's an important case, and I think it's, at the same time, there are dangers in that. At the same time, when one looks for the direct connection without any sort of foundation or without any sort of community, then we get into these really kind of bizarre expressions of kind of homemade spirituality, customized spirituality. I'll take a little bit here and I'll take a little bit there, and whatever, you know, whatever kind of fits my personality or what I want out of this, then I can kind of construct my own sense of connection to God, which doesn't require any of the kind of self-denial or discipline that all the major religious faiths and traditions have historically emphasized. So I see that as a danger or as an issue in all of this. At the same time, that I am very conscious of that, of the reason for the desire for that sort of move.
Let's go on. Bring again someone else into the conversation. Bloomington, Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Could I comment on the significance of the millennium in Bible prophecy? There is no specific prophecy about Christ's return at any specific return of any millennium, and that idea is nothing but an extrapolation there of some pretty far out, quite a stretch of theology. The Bible teachers, there are some Bible teachers that have mentioned it, but I have never heard it emphasized among teachers of prophecy, because it's simply not primary. And there's nothing in the Bible that directly connects the turn of the millennium with the second coming of Christ. What is primary in prophecy is the restoration of the nation of Israel. That's the start of the countdown, when Israel is restored as a nation, and also the fact that Israel will be constant trouble. There won't be any time when Israel isn't in trouble, and isn't not only in trouble but troubling the entire world, and the world will, there will be an axis of nations that will finally just absolutely run against Israel in order to actually crush her, and guess what? She wins big. But what is also important in Bible prophecy is the computer and the television age, which makes many of the end-time prophecies possible. Prior to this age, many of those end-time prophecies were absurd. They simply could not have occurred because we didn't have weapons that could kill that many people, and we didn't have armies that large. The Book of Revelation talks about a 200 million man army. There, armies of that large are now possible and are even developing in China and in the Orient, and that's, by the way, where they come, where the Bible says they're going to come from. Also, the increase in infectious diseases, disease epidemics, infectious diseases, diseases we can't control, in an age of medical sophistication, also an increase of killer earthquakes. We just had one yesterday. And an increase in natural disasters. All of these things are predicted by the Bible as signs of the end time. But the turn of the millennium is not mentioned as a specific sign. However, the conjunction of all these things coming together when they are now, causes many people to think this is the time.
Yeah, I would like to respond to just the first part of your statement there, and I agree with the recognition that this is not particularly scripturally emphasized. So, where do you think all the hoopla about the millennium is coming from? Is this being generated by the mass media? If it's not coming out of fundamentalist end times Christianity, where's it coming from?
Well, the theology that I have heard about it, and it's quite a stretch, the idea that God made the universe, the heaven and the earth, in 6 days, that a day is to God as 1,000 years, all that scripture doesn't mean that a day is to God as 1,000 years, it simply means that God is independent of time. but they take it literally that the day is to God as 1,000 years, and remember, in six days God made the heaven and the earth, and that there have been 6,000 years since the creation of the earth, that the end of this millennium would be this beginning of the seventh day, that would be the start of the rest, and therefore it would probably be about this time that Christ would return.
Okay.
That is a stretch.
Yeah.
That is a stretch. And I don't, you know, you can buy it if you want to, but I don't pay much attention to it.
Right.
I don't know whether I have that exactly correct, because I have paid so little attention to when some prophecy teachers have even mentioned it, that I don't even know whether I've got it right.
Yeah.
But
I've paid very little attention to any of it, because I've taken seriously when the disciples asked Jesus when he was going to come back, he said he didn't have any idea, only God knew, it seems to me that historically that Christians have wasted an awful lot of time and energy trying to figure out what's going to happen, rather than being willing to address the issues that are happening at this very moment to, you know, people all over the world. And it seems to me that that would be a more important aspect of the faith to be emphasizing.
The idea that Jesus said that he didn't know when he was going to come back. He had restricted himself to a human body at that time. He did say that the Father knew when he was going to come back. And there is some very interesting theology. The prophecy of the end time has an association with Jewish wedding customs, and the way that the church being the bride of Christ, the way that a young Jewish girl would accept a proposition of marriage, would proposal of marriage, would be that she would the young man, she would accept the proposal of marriage, and the young man would then go and build an extension onto his father's house, because after he married her, that's where they would live. They would live in the extension of his father's house. Now, when he built that extension, only the father would be the judge of when that extension of the house was ready for him to go get his bride. In other words, it was the father's choice. And so there's an interesting bit of theology that when Jesus said it was the father's call as to when he was to go get his bride, that has to that has a great reflection upon the, and if to study the relationship between the wedding customs and the relationship of Christ and his church, you could go deeply into that. That's extremely interesting, but in this particular aspect of it is that a father of a Jewish man who was about to get married was the father that told the young man, the extension that you have built on our house is now adequate. It is adequate to house you and your wife. You may now go and get your wife. So it was the father's call.
Forgive me for interrupting. Sure. I only have about 10 minutes, sure. And I do have another caller. If you would indulge me, I think probably we need to move on.
Sure.
Well, thanks for the call. Mm-hmm. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and I want to introduce our guest. We're speaking with William Sutton. He teaches history at University High School and has since 1992, except for a one-year period when he was visiting assistant professor at the U of I Department of History. He has a Ph.D. in history from the U of I, which he received in 1993. His particular area of interest is history of American Protestantism, and he is the lead speaker in a series, Dialogue into the Millennium, also called Millennium 2000, a series of talks that will take place at the St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana, stretching into the year 2001. And he is the lead speaker in the series, and we're hoping that we'll have a number of the speakers here on this program in the years to come. If we're all still here, we'll be doing it. We'll continue, of course, talking for the next 10 minutes or so. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Urbana is next, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Hi, Bill. This is Steve. How you doing?
Hey, Steve. How are you?
Good to hear you on the radio.
Thanks.
I wanted to hear you say something about why you think evangelicalism in the last 20 years or so has had such a politically conservative orientation. I know in your own work that you look at just the opposite, at ways in which that faith has given rise in the 19th century to politics of a much more progressive bent. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about why it is that that's not at all the case, or seemingly not at all the case in the last 20 years. I'll hang up and give it a listen.
All right.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you, Steve. You know, I just read a review of a book that covered aspects of William Jennings Bryan at the Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925, and the review mentioned that the author says that at this point, what the Scopes Monkey Trial did was divorce evangelical Protestantism from progressive politics as exemplified by William Jennings Bryan. And I thought it was a very astute observation. Not that you can take one event and extrapolate all this from that, but my sense is that the real marginalization, the increasing marginalization of evangelical Protestantism, put Protestants into such a strange psychological space that their only response, or their major response, was defensive. When they began to emerge from this to some extent in the 50s, it seems to me they had an opportunity to either continue to take a kind of a prophetic countercultural role, or to step into step back into a kind of a cultural mainstream role. And it seems like, you know, kind of psychologically, the second option is always preferable. It's certainly easier. It's certainly more comfortable. It's in the sense of once being at the center, then being outside, and now a chance to be back at the center. It seems to me that evangelical Protestants went for it, and particularly in the context, of course, of anti-communism, and this thing I was suggesting earlier, the kind of moral myopia towards the inherent, or at least the problematic morality of large-scale corporate capitalist growth, a morality that was extremely obvious to 19th century Protestants, to many 19th century Protestants, evangelicals, not all of them, obviously. So it seems to me that process certainly figured into this, and the idea of being kind of seduced into a sort of a marginal acceptance, evangelical Protestants, I think, went for it. And it's an easy thing to do in America, or it's an easy thing for Protestants to do in America. But, you take the case of Billy Graham, who I think at some point in his life, after Richard Nixon had rather thoroughly used what he could of Billy Graham, I think at some point in his life he figured that out and was willing to step back and take a more prophetic stance in his, particularly in his condemnation of nuclear war and the whole nuclear buildup. So that's a kind of a long-winded runaround. But my hope, of course, is that evangelical Protestants will recover some of this lost tradition and remember that there's nothing inherently part of their faith that says they have to be mainstream, that they have to somehow make sacred the ways of the culture in which they live, that in fact there's something in their tradition that calls them to be prophetic, which of course requires discipline and there's a certain risk involved, but I think ultimately that's the call that it should take seriously.
You have touched a couple of times on the ways in which post-war, particularly Cold War American democracy has looked for philosophical underpinning to, in a sense, capitalism in a secular sense and Christianity in a sacred sense, and that those sorts of three things, democracy, capitalism, Christianity, in a lot of people's minds have now become very tightly linked. Maybe not always that way, but certainly since the Cold War have become very tightly linked. And perhaps there always have also been people who have been critical of that, particularly that link of capitalism and Christianity, maybe a little bit more so since the 60s. As we move ahead, do you think that do we expect that those three things, capitalism, Christianity, the way Americans think about what American democracy is all about, will continue to be so tightly linked, or particularly coming out of coming from people of faith, we might see some more critique of these sort of bedrock assumptions about, if you're doing well, it means God is smiling on you?
Excellent question. I can be hopeful about this without necessarily being optimistic, if you understand the differentiation. Sure. There. It seems to me that as long as the economy is booming, nobody's going to ask any questions. They're not even going to ask any questions about Bill Clinton, let alone about more important issues. But it does seem to me that at some point the economy will no longer be booming, and there already, it seems to me, is a recognition among many Americans that something is not quite right. With the economy booming as it is, we should be all very optimistic about everything. And in fact, there seems to be a general malaise among the population. Those in the middle class at some level seem to be conscious of the fact that the middle class may be shrinking and that they may fall out of it at some point. Those not in the middle class are not seeing very many opportunities to join the middle class. The disparity between the very wealthy and everybody else is growing. The maldistribution of wealth is getting worse, not better. It seems to me that at some point, if somehow the economy bottoms out, and they always seem to do that, it seems to me that at that point there will be a time for new questions. And if the church, if the leadership of the church, if the prophetic voice of the church is ready to step into that, then I think something very good can come out of that. And I think we can start to re-question. See, communism is no longer the boogeyman. You know, communism is gone. There is no more boogeyman, right? So, mm-hmm. So the question becomes: Can we recognize perhaps what the real boogeyman is, or what, how will we reconstruct the boogeyman? Well, it seems to me that there are some very powerful arguments to be made that, you know, global, multinational, corporate economic structures are the antithesis of democracy, and in fact, in a spiritual sense, are very blasphemous. They take the place of God. And if evangelical Protestants and other people begin to recognize that, then I'm hopeful that something different might take place. That's not to say that I'm optimistic about that.
Well, there we will have to stop with the promise that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear more from our guest this morning, Bill Sutton, as he gives the first talk in the series, Dialogue into the Millennium, Considering the Past, Reflections on the Present, Hope for the Future, at St. Patrick's Parish Center in Urbana, 708 West Main, next Thursday, 7:30 in the evening. This is the first talk in their Millennium 2000 series. We hope to speak with many of these guests in the weeks, months, and years to come. Bill Sutton teaches at Uni High. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Here.